Good afternoon. My name is Leah, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Renewable Heating and Cooling Webinar Series Multifamily Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. Thank you. James Crutchfield, you may begin.
Thank you. Welcome everybody to EPA's second installment of our Renewable Heating and Cooling Webinar Series. My name is James Crutchfield. I work here at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and I'm happy to welcome a group of speakers today that are going to be focusing on solar water heating for multifamily and affordable housing buildings. A few webinar logistics issues just to take a few minutes here. As was mentioned, all attendees will be placed on global mute for the duration of today's webinar. In order to ask a question, please type it into the text box at the bottom of the Q&A window on the right-hand side of your screen. Questions will be fielded at the end of today's webinar. And also a PDF of today's presentation as well as an audio replay will be made available to all registrants. Access information will be provided by email after today's webinar, so keep an eye out for that. Just a little bit about how we structure our webinars here on the Renewable Heating and Cooling webinar series. We typically start off with a technical speaker that will cover the broad opportunities of solar water heating in today's sector focus. And then we're going to follow that up with two project speakers who will provide us some experience in a couple projects that have actually been implemented into different high-rise as well as affordable housing buildings. And as I mentioned, we'll follow that up with the Q&A session towards the end. So our first speaker today is Dr. Ben Gravely. He has been in the industry for more than three decades, and he has experience in the design, installation, and manufacturing of solar water heating systems and components. He is a co-founder of the North Carolina Solar Center as well as the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. He's designed and installed several thousand systems covering residential, commercial, and military as well as institutional customers. So with that, I'll turn over the control to you, Doctor, and you have the floor.
Okay, thank you, James. As he said, my focus this afternoon is to give you a brief technical perspective on how to apply solar to multifamily buildings. And I want to do that by, I want to do it very briefly. We don't have much time individually here. And I want to point out that there are a lot of architectural methods for making things look good or invisible, and those are between the owner and the designer, the architect, whoever's putting it in. I've got a series of photos here in this first slide that shows you different apartment buildings with solar systems on them. You can see that all of them except the one in the upper right, the little one, have large arrays that feed the whole building. The little one that's in the upper right is individual arrays that feed each apartment, so they are equivalent to a residential solar hot water system. The others are central water systems that feed the whole building. The middle one on the right is actually in China, if you see the Chinese language written there. They're going full blast on this. There are other designs that can be used. You can see over on the right, you see that collector array, and that's on top of that high-rise apartment building right underneath it. Many arrays you can't see at all, so whether you can see them or not see them, it depends upon the structure of the building. If you are have a building or a project that is brand new, then it's very easy to design the solar to look the way you want it to or to be invisible. You can build it into a roof. You can build dormers that you put the collectors on. There's a lot of ways to do it. The lower right picture in this slide is of a high school that was converted into a low-income housing apartment complex. This is the backside, so the collector array doesn't look any worse than that stuff to the right up there, which is heating and air conditioning equipment. So my point in these two slides is just simply to say there are a lot of options as to how do these things look, how they're applied to the buildings, that is the collector part. And a lot of that is up to the owner and the designer, both on existing buildings and on new buildings. There are some buildings where there's a parapet or a mansard roof, and you can simply mount the collectors right on that. Other people have done a dormer array across a building. So there are lots of different choices. So let's talk about a very brief description of how solar systems work. There are several different kinds. I'm only going to describe one kind. They all work very similar ways, but I'm just going to give you a brief overview of one kind and how you can make it work. So here's a slide that shows a very simple system. It shows a couple of collectors. It shows piping to the collectors at the bottom, piping from the collector back. You pump water up through the collectors. It spills down that return line and spills back into the tank. And over the period of a day, it slowly heats that tank up. We don't heat the tank up instantaneously. We heat it up over the whole solar day. We drag it up by its bootstraps, if you want to think of it that way. So once we've got that tank of water hot, then we can use it to do various things. Here's a system diagram of a very simple domestic hot water system. You see the cold water up there at the top, the DCW is domestic cold water. That cold water goes to the building to the right, and then it goes through your water heater and is heated up, and you get DHW, domestic hot water. To put a solar system on that is very simple. You simply hook it in on the cold side. You put a valve in there to shut off the line and make the water go through the heat exchanger, and you've now preheated the water going into the water heater. So all the water heater has to do is finish it off. You may get 100% of your heat from the solar on a given day. You may get zero. So your water heater is always there. It's full power, and it will always make sure you have hot water. And the more solar you get, the better. The lower your bill is. So solar is a variable. Space heating can be done. Here's a forced air space heating. Typical space heating has a blower, and the blower blows air through some kind of furnace, a gas and oil furnace or a heat pump. So if you want to hook solar into space heating, you simply stick a water coil in between the blower and the furnace, and then you can get heat out of the solar tank through that solar coil. So it's a fairly simple technique and technology. It's been done for 50 years. Whether or not solar space heating is good depends upon your climate and what how much time the thing will spend running. You don't want a great big system tuned for the winter, and then it sit there 6 months out of the year doing nothing. So you have to know your climate and your heat loads on the building. If there's a pool in your complex, this is a typical pool loop. On my screen, it's a little blurry, but the blue there is just simply a pump going through by a boiler. That upper red thing on the left is a boiler to heat the water. It loops back around through a chemical dispenser and into the pool. Hooking solar to that is also pretty simple. You just simply interrupt the line on the cold side, and you put some heat in it from the solar tank, and then it goes onto the boiler. And the boiler does the same thing as a water heater would do. It just finishes it off. So you have preheating with the solar and finishing it with a regular boiler or heater of some sort. So what are the challenges and what are the opportunities? Well, the challenge is to find a good solar thermal application, and we've just seen three. We've seen domestic hot water, we've seen space heating, and we've seen pool heating. So your application may be one of those, it may be two, it may be all three. The second thing you have to do is say, is there a simple architectural fit? Can we get the collector somewhere? Can we get the tank somewhere? Can we get the piping in between? We want the collectors to face south. We want the tank solar tank to be inside the building in a mechanical room if possible, and we have lots of ways to do that. Some people say, I simply can't do it. My building is not shaped right, and from all the different ways we've done it in the past, we can usually find a solution. If you're planning a brand new facility, then it's much easier because you have the option of making space available and not having equipment on the roof where you can't put the collectors. You have some choices. Here's an example here of a five-story building in Boston. It was built in 1897, so it's obviously not a new building. And it needed 45 collectors. And as you can see from this, over on the right-hand picture, the second row of collectors is actually hanging over a window that is, and we have put it up in the air to cover it. And that area is over a hallway, so you don't see the collectors looking up through the window. And it makes a very good installation. If you look down there at the right, that little round thing that looks like a cigarette, that is the solar tank. That's in proportion to the size of the building and the size of the collector rays, and there's a little man standing in front of it and one in front of the building. I did that just to show you a physical proportion of this stuff. That's 2,000 gallons of water. That's like a couple of minivans back to back. And you say, well, there's just simply no way I could get that in an existing building. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes we can find a way. One way that it works is to simply put an enclosure and enclose that tank. We'd rather not have it getting in the rain and the water. We're putting heat in there, and we want the heat to stay there. We don't want it to be washed away with rain and blown away with the wind. So everything works better if it's in an enclosure of one sort. So if it can't go in the building, it can go into an extension of the building. It can go into an equipment, an enclosure of this sort. The sky's the limit as to what kinds of things can be done. Let's talk a minute about market trends. One of the things people want to know is solar coming or going? How hard is it to get this stuff? People that can talk to me. And the pros are that systems are proven, they're durable, they're reliable. There are design and trade skills people out there that know how to do this. There are various incentives for the state and federal and some utilities. There's a growing financing market. And the cons are roughly the same thing. There are not a lot of people out there that know how to design and install these. There are many places where the codes, the plumbing and piping codes, are not very uniform, and so you have to have a company that can go to the code people and make sure they'll accept the equipment. The incentives do vary from state to state. The constant in this is the federal government incentive at 30%, and then each state has its own. There are long-term political problems that could occur. The climate for incentives for solar can vary with whichever party is in power, and so that can come and go. Most other countries of the world, Europe and Asia, they have long-range fixed energy policies and long-range fixed incentives, and you don't have to worry every 5 years whether you're going to have the incentives taken away. Once you have a system installed, you're good. There's no problem. Those of us in the business are always looking ahead to see how what's happening on the market front with tax incentives and other things. Financing infrastructure is out there, but it's not everywhere. So you can't walk in any bank and finance one of these, but there are financial groups being put together that can do third-party leasing and other things, and I think you're going to hear some of that here shortly. The conclusion of this is that you really do need to deal with experienced people, and everything can be done if you have experienced people who've been through this, who know where the loopholes are, who know how to make it all work, both mechanically and financially. So with that, I think I've used up my time, and I will pass on to the next person.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ben. Just a reminder for everybody out there who has a question, there is a question and answer screen on the right-hand side of your monitor, and you can type in a question at the bottom of that, and we will be fielding questions at the end of the webinar.
I'm sorry. You know what? I did miss one slide.
Go ahead and cover it now if you'd like.
Yeah, let me finish it. Okay. Economics, I'm going to give you a very first-order economics. The other speakers, I think, are going to cover economics in more detail. What we do is a rule of thumb, a real first-order thing. Let's say that one collector will put out 8 million BTUs over a year, and it costs $4,500 a collector to install it, and we expect the system to run 20 years. We can take these numbers and say, okay, 20 years at 8 million is 160 million BTUs. It costs $4,500. That's $28 per million BTUs. That's the energy cost from the solar, amortizing the whole system. That's equivalent to 9 cents a kilowatt hour. And you say, well, okay, my energy is cheaper than that or it's more expensive. This, you must consider this to be a 20-year or lifetime of the system average. So what is the average value of electricity or oil or gas going to be over 20 years, not just right this instant? You have to factor in the efficiency of your boiler or your furnace. If you have an 80% efficient furnace, then whatever you're paying for fuel coming to the furnace, you multiply it by one and a quarter that's the cost of the energy going into the building on the other side of the furnace. And if it's only 65% efficient, you multiply your incoming fuel cost by 1.53 to see what your delivered cost is. So that's a very simple back-of-the-napkin way of determining what the solar energy value is. Then you need to look at a threshold value and say to yourself, what do I think the average value is going to be over 20 years? If you've got natural gas today at $1 a therm, that's $2 per million, $10 per million. That's a lot cheaper than 28. If your furnace efficiency is 65%, all of a sudden it's $15 per million. You've got to decide if it's going to go back up to $2 like it was 5 years ago. That's already $20 per million, and one and a half times that, you're $30 per million, so you're ahead of the solar. So you have to factor all these in. It has to be done per job. This is part of the engineering task to see if there's a good economic situation there. Now I'm finished, and I'll pass it on.
All right. Thanks. The economics are always an important part of taking a look at projects, so didn't want to miss that. All right, so let's move on to our next speaker. As I mentioned, Dr. Gravely had covered sort of the broad opportunities, and now we're actually going to get into some actual project experience here. Our next speaker is Mr. Harry Richter. He brings more than 20 years in high-rise residential building management to the table, and he has recently taken this expertise into the consulting sector. He works for High-Rise Consulting, where he supports building owners on a host of issues spanning from facility management to sustainable building practices. Mr. Richter was instrumental in deploying a solar water heating system into a condominium complex here in the local Washington, D.C. area, and I'm pleased to give you the floor and tell us a little bit about that project.
Thank you, James. I became involved in 4600 Connecticut Avenue in 2010. Working with their board of directors, our goals were to maximize the physical plant's efficiency while reducing operating costs. And since energy was the building's largest expense, we started there. The building is a nine-story brick facade building with 267 units located in Northwest Washington, D.C. Has a central boiler system for domestic hot water, space heating, and laundry equipment. The solar system that we installed was completed in March of 2012, so we're right at the very beginning of this project, and we're learning something new every day, it seems. The board of directors had already taken steps to reduce energy consumption by changing their T12 fluorescent fixtures to T8s and replacing older air conditioning equipment with newer, more efficient equipment. They'd also entered into long-term purchase agreements for electricity and natural gas. They'd done as much as possible along traditional lines, and it seemed it was time to explore sustainable energy options. That's where solar thermal came to our attention. Reaching the decision to go with a solar system, we first had to overcome some questions and a few objections. Solar thermal was considered a good fit for the roof space available, but some of the concerns were whether the roof, which was designed and built in 1957, would support the panels. Another concern was the impact on the roof's warranty. This roof was most recently installed in 2006 and was still under a manufacturer's warranty. There were concerns about how the insulation would affect the appearance of the building, and I see this as a pretty common concern, even with other buildings that I've spoken to about this project. And, of course, the cost and payback period were major concerns. Skyline Innovations provided the solution and answers to the board's questions, as well as some very creative financing options. Skyline commissioned an engineering study of the roof's construction to confirm that it could handle the weight of the panels. This was the first step in the project to see whether it was viable going forward. They then hired the contractor that had installed the roof in 2006 to make all the roof penetrations so that the warranty would remain in effect through the project. Working with Solar Energy Systems, which was a local insulation company, Skyline designed the array so that it could not be seen from the street, addressing the concern that some people had about how it would affect the building's appearance. If you'll notice the way the panels are set back on the left side of the roof, that's the front of the building. There's no public access to the rear of the building, so the panels could be closer to the right side of the roof. From the street, none of the panels are visible. This particular system works just about exactly as Dr. Ben described in his presentations. The solar panels contribute to energy conservation by preheating the municipal water before it reaches our hot water heater. By preheating the incoming water, our boiler has less work to do bringing the water up to operating temperature. The installation, I'm told, is one of the largest residential installations in Washington, D.C. The biggest concern going into the project was financing. The condominium is a not-for-profit entity, so it was unable to take advantage of the tax credits which the project qualified for. Skyline stepped in with a win-win solution, we felt. Skyline would pay for the project, every phase from the initial engineering work, purchase of materials, installation, maintenance, monitoring. There would be no initial cost to the condominium whatsoever. In return, the condominium would purchase the energy generated by the solar panels at a guaranteed rate equal to 65% of the price the local utility charged. The agreement would last for 10 years. After which Skyline would have recouped its investment and profit, and at that point, ownership of the system would transfer to the condominium at no additional cost. At that point, the energy generated by the solar panels would be essentially free to the condominium. Since we expect the life expectancy of the system to be about 25 to 30 years, the condominium would enjoy 15 to 20 years of free energy, essentially. The only expense involved in running the system was the electricity used on the motor for the circulating pump. The board of directors had always felt that if they could substitute energy from a sustainable source like solar without increasing operating costs, they had a responsibility as building owners to do that. If they could move to sustainable energy and save money in the process, the decision would be a no-brainer. And if they could move to sustainable energy with zero capital investment, as this project offered, there was no rational excuse not to do so. They were very happy with the project as framed by Skyline, which made this project possible. This was a project that they had not budgeted for and didn't really have capital to invest in. One of the unforeseen benefits of the system, I think this particular chart shows very well, is that it measures the temperature of the incoming municipal water, which we had never done before. And this solved a mystery in the building that we've been struggling with for years. From time to time, management would get complaints from residents that the cold water coming out of their faucets was tepid, not cold. And we naturally assumed that somewhere in the building, hot water was bleeding into a cold water line and affecting the temperature. And we spent a lot of time searching for faulty single control faucets or defective shower handheld shower heads that might be the cause of this problem. But the moment we first saw this chart, the answer to the riddle was obvious. During the summer months, the incoming municipal water averaged 80 degrees. We had expected the water temperature to be fairly consistent year-round at around 55 to 60 degrees. But in the area where this building is located, the municipal system is close to the surface, and the water temperature fluctuates from 50 degrees in winter to 80 degrees in summer. So that was a benefit we didn't anticipate, and it solved a problem that we have been dealing with for a while. This chart also provides the easiest visualization of just how much energy the solar panels contribute to the boiler. This particular chart is for the 31 days of July 2012. The green section of each column represents the increase in water temperature derived from the solar panels. The orange sections of each column show what's left for the boiler to do. So it's easy to see from this just what contribution the solar panels are making to heat our domestic hot water compared to what the boiler has left to do. Another benefit we didn't anticipate was the ability to use the data generated by the solar thermal system to analyze the operation of our boilers. With the solar panels providing about 90% of our domestic hot water energy during summer months, we questioned why we weren't seeing a more dramatic drop in natural gas bills for those months. The building has four boilers used to provide heat and hot water in the winter and just hot water in the summer. After this first summer with the solar panels, we learned that our HVAC contractor was running two boilers constantly during the summer months to make hot water. They continued this practice after the solar panels were installed. It meant that we were running boilers when there was no call for heat to make hot water. We were in the process of switching boiler controls so that next summer the boilers will only fire when the domestic hot water system needs additional heat. We found that, as often happens, implementing one program to conserve energy can expose other ways to save that were not initially obvious. There is another reason that the board felt now is the time to move forward with this project. Washington, D.C. has just recently passed legislation that will require all commercial and residential buildings to report their annual energy consumption. And other cities around the country either have done so or are looking into this. With almost 50% of all energy consumed in America being used to heat, cool, and light buildings, board of directors felt that the day is approaching where buildings will have to meet energy consumption guidelines based on their size and use. Since there's no guarantee that rebates and tax credits that made this project feasible will continue indefinitely, now was the time, they felt, to take advantage of Skyline's proposal. And finally, for those who raise objections about how the panels would affect the appearance of our building, having lived with them now for about 6 months and had many people come up to look at them, I can only say we can't wait for the next Google Earth images to get a nicer view of our roof. We imagine that our neighbors may be jealous. Thank you, James. That's the end of my presentation.
Great. Thank you, Harry. It looks like we have a few questions coming in from folks, and that's great. As I mentioned, we'll be handling those questions as we move towards the end of the presentations today. So if you do have a question, please take a moment to type it in the bottom of the question and answer window on the right-hand side of your screen, and we'll get to each of those questions at the end. So let's move on to our next presenter. Ms. Nina Janapal has been the CEO of Arlington Partnership for Affordable Housing since 2007. She's had several leadership positions on the Community Energy Advisory Group, the Virginia Housing Development Authority, as well as being the president of the Housing Association of Nonprofit Developers. Through those that tenure, she's received several awards, including Developer of the Year under the Housing Association of Nonprofit Developers, and also the Nonprofit Business of the Year from the Arlington Chamber of Commerce. So with that, I'll pass things over to you, Nina, and we look forward to hearing about your project in the affordable housing community.
This is the introductory slide here, just telling you a little bit about our organization. We're based in Arlington, Virginia. We have 12 properties with 995 rental homes. Our mission is to own, develop, and preserve quality, affordable homes that enhance the Arlington community. Our properties are funded with a mix of the low-income housing tax credits, the federal home loan program, Virginia and county gap financing. We are the only affordable housing developer committed to work exclusively in Arlington. We got approached by Skyline, same group that worked on Harry Richter's property, the condominium, and looked at our portfolio and tried to identify a property that would be appropriate for solar panels on them. First thing we looked for was a property that had central hot water heat. A lot of the recent renovations that we've done, APA has long been committed to green renovations, have involved providing individual systems. So most of our properties, we have a variety of aquatherm systems, instant hot water systems. We have other energy efficient systems which don't lend themselves, we thought, to the central form of solar hot water. We did identify a couple properties that did. The It was originally built in 1954. We purchased it in 2003. And when Skyline approached us late last year, 2011, we had just completed a major renovation 2 years earlier. In that renovation, we had done a number of energy efficient moves, new roof, insulation, new windows, and new hot water heaters. However, we were intrigued by this solar hot water concept that was partly impacted by the fact that I was at the same time serving on the county's energy plan advisory group, and Arlington County has a large commitment to reducing our greenhouse gas output and our energy usage. And so I saw this as an opportunity to participate in that plan and try something out. The system that we got from Skyline uses the sun, these solar collectors. That's at the top of one of our buildings. This is a walk-up garden apartment complex. All the buildings are three or four stories. The panels collect the heat, and Skyline installed the entire system for us. It goes down along the side of the building and into the existing hot water rooms, the furnace and hot water rooms. Their project was funded by some grant funds. This was part of the stimulus money that the state of Virginia got. Virginia created a solar and wind power rebate program. They applied for all the grant money. They did the engineering. They did the financing. They approached us initially to put solar panels on our entire property. Unfortunately, those funds weren't available, so we ended up only getting some of those installed. About a third of our property has the solar hot water heating. One thing I want to talk about that's a little unique, some of these are unique for us, but maybe for anyone who goes into this solar hot water process, is your due diligence process. Of course, we checked out Skyline. We actually visited the property that was just talked about, Harry Richter's property. It was as well as their installer. We had an attorney work with us on reviewing the contract terms and the repayment conditions. And also, a big issue for us was liability. We, too, in 2009, and we wanted to make sure that if something goes wrong with this system, that there's Skyline, or Skyline will stand behind that, but also that we had done our due diligence to make sure that it was being installed properly. We had a special, so that involved a mechanical engineer. We hired a mechanical engineer to review the plans and a structural engineer to check that our roof was going to support this. We also had Skyline check with our roof installer, and they used them to install the solar panels and continue the roof warranty that we had, so that wasn't violated. Something unique for our work is that the low-income housing tax credit program involves a limited partnership. So we had to double check that this would not impact the way we had calculated our tax credits, that this would not be considered, for example, a commercial lease. We can't lease out part of our property commercially. So our due diligence involved getting a sign-off from the Virginia Housing Development Authority that issues our tax credits, from our limited partner investor, in this case it was M&T Bank, and from Arlington County. So it was a fairly significant amount of staff time. I maybe even underestimated it. and all those various parties needed some information on what we were doing and how the deal was structured to make their decision. So this process took us a couple of months, and we estimated about $8,000 in third-party costs. This slide shows the actual solar collectors. You can see here on the storage tanks, initially Skyline had proposed one large storage tank in each of the three buildings that they put the solar panels on. However, it was hard to get access into our maintenance rooms. It's down a half flight of stairs. So they had in one large tank. It involves a fairly sophisticated monitoring system. One reason that's important, for example, is that the water from solar panels can exceed the residential limits for what's comfortable. So when I was down there this summer, they weren't even using the solar panels because the hot water had already hit the maximum temperature. So it's constantly being monitored. These tanks are basically acting like big batteries, storing that hot water during the middle of the day for probably our peak use, which is in the morning and the evening. There's three solar hot water systems that were installed. Each one actually serves two buildings, so that covered six of our 19 buildings. Again, the hope initially was to cover the entire property. Skyline invested $230,000 to do that, 19 panels, and then 800 gallons of storage for that hot water. They completed that this summer. This is the difference between the current Virginia washing gas rates that we're paying and the Skyline rate. So we do pay 50% of what we would have paid to the utilities to Skyline. My understanding is that they have the grant funds, but also they had some investors, and so they wanted some return on this and to help pay their operating costs. They maintain the operation of the facilities. This is a chart showing the actual energy that's been delivered by Skyline. Well, they're estimating that the savings for the first 5 months of operation is $775. That's annualized for a year. Our hot water bill, I should have said this at the beginning, averages between $32,000 and $35,000 a year for the entire property. So let's say if this is about a third of our property, about $10,000 a year. So we're hoping that this will offset about 20 to 30% of our energy costs for hot water. Some of my conclusions, having worked through this process, is number one, be prepared to act quickly on one-time or emerging state incentive programs. I think Dr. Gravely referred to that at the beginning, that these things come and go, and perhaps if we had acted a little more quickly, we could have gotten the entire building covered, not just part of it. That actually ties to another one of my recommendations, is we need to look for scale opportunities. By the time we invested that in due diligence costs, it actually hasn't been a great return on our investment. We'll probably be looking for 5 years of this payback at $1,850 a year to justify our investment of time and money in the due diligence, not to mention, Skyline's investment. I think this is a wonderful system. I mean, other than the small amount of work that we put into due diligence, obviously Skyline assembled this team and does the monitoring, and that would have been a burden on us. I don't think we would have done it. The payback just doesn't look like it would have been there, not to mention the fact that, we're a busy nonprofit. We have other things we work on, so this isn't our main thing to look for energy savings opportunities. I'm hoping that we'll get a good return over the long haul. The lifespan of these solar systems is supposed to be closer to 20 years, and at year 10, that savings sharing with Skyline will go away, and Apple will get 100% of the savings. And this is just a little bit about our organization again. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nina. That was interesting. Okay, we're going to move on to our question and answer session now. As I mentioned before, you can type your questions into the text box at the bottom of the question and answer window, and we have more than several already put into the system. So I'll just start walking through these. The first question has to do with the type of heat storage, commercial heat storage tank. Are these tanks typically custom tanks? What are they made up of? What type of technical aspects does the tank have that you could tell us about? And this might be a good question for Ben.
Yes. One of my slides talked about the Wild Wild West, and you can buy a tank made out of anything from chewing gum to almost gold or stainless steel. Most solar storage tanks are made out of plain steel. Water heaters, as you well know, are steel with a glass coating inside, and a lot of water heaters are used for solar storage. The biggest water heater you can buy is 120 gallons, so when you need a couple of thousand gallons, it becomes quite a tedious task to buy a bunch of 120 gallons and make them into a large storage as a unified storage. My company manufactures bigger tanks, so we go to 3,000, 4,000 gallons. We go as big as we can actually physically put together and ship on a truck. So let me say that typical is a steel tank with insulation around it, and you size the tank according to the square footage of collectors. How many square feet of active area of the collector do you have? And you typically do 1.25 gallons per square foot up to 1.5 gallons per square foot. So that's a long answer to a short question, but you can get caught. There are people that make plastic tanks, and you don't want those in a commercial situation. Some of them have rubber liners. Those are all, the lifetime of those is unknown in a tough situation. You don't find a boiler made out of plastic or a water heater made out of plastic. So we recommend that you use the kind of materials you buy from people that have the materials just like your boilers and your water heaters and your other big tanks.
Great. Yeah, that's a good good answer. Next question may be directed at Harry. Does the solar on the building that you were talking about serve domestic hot water, or was it also serving space heating?
Just domestic hot water right now.
Okay. As a follow-up to that, and this would be for either of Harry or Nina, did the condo group or the affordable housing group forfeit all the tax incentives and renewable energy certificates that were produced by the system, given that your developer had ownership for approximately 10 years?
Let me go first on that, Nina. Since as a condominium, we pay very little tax. It would have taken, and the tax credit, I believe, on this project was a 30% of the cost of the installation. It would have taken so long to recoup that that it wasn't considered by the board to be an option for us if we were to go it on our own. So giving that up and letting Skyline assume the ownership of the system initially, we don't feel that we were adversely affected in any way. In fact, it made the entire project possible.
I have the same answer. This is Nina, that we have a very complicated ownership structure with our limited partner investor, and the time it would have taken to incentives that some of the other states and the district have.
James, can I put my 2 cents worth in here?
Sure, absolutely.
What we're talking about is two different ways of buying these systems. If you have a nonprofit or someone with no tax appetite, as we call it, then you put together a bunch of external investors who form a corporation, and they buy the system and own it and operate it. And it's called, it's a third-party ownership. And that third-party investors do have a tax appetite. They do need tax credits. They do need incentives. And so what that allows them to do is put a system on a building and not charge the building owner or user anything. And all of the benefits, all of the tax incentives go to the investors simply because the building cannot use them. So who uses that? Well, low-income housing that's owned by a city. City pays no taxes. Public jails. I know this is not multifamily housing except obliquely, but jails, dormitories on colleges. So there are a lot of nonprofit institutions out there, hospitals, for example, that there's no way you could put a system on their building if you had to rely on the incentive going to the user of it. So that's one option. The other option is that the user is a taxable organization, does have profits, and can take the incentives. So you've got either or here, and sometimes a little bit of a mix. So these are all negotiated per project, as to whether it's strictly a third-party tax incentive program or whether there's some sharing of incentives between the owner and the third party. And all of that boils down to then is what you pay for the energy going in the building. If you put a black box around the whole thing, roughly the same economics have to happen. How you divide it up inside that black box, it depends upon the project itself.
Great point. I was wondering if perhaps it sounds like the different systems that were featured today were flat panel, but is there any pros and cons associated with applications where you might consider using vacuum tube collectors versus the flat panel collectors? And what types of applications might those be?
The installation at 4600 is tubes, but Dr. Gravely could probably give you better insight into that.
There are multiple kinds of solar collectors. The most common type is flat plate. Flat plate simply means that there's this black plate of metal sitting in the sun under a pane of glass, and it gets hot. Evacuated tube collectors use strips of black absorber inside an evacuated bottle, and the whole purpose of that is you lose less of the heat. A solar collector only gains heat one way by the solar radiation coming in, but it loses heat three different ways. It radiates some back out. It has conduction and convection. So the evacuated tube collectors and the flat plate are what you see most often. Evacuated tube, they all have different characteristics. You can look at the mathematics of absorption of each one and decide which is best for your project. In general, up to 140 degrees or so, the flat plate performs better, and above that, the evacuated tube performs better. And we actually do an energy balance equation to show which one you ought to use. They have different characteristics, different lifetimes, different longevities, so those are all factored in when you look at the project.
Either of the two projects that were featured, are you pursuing any sort of LEED designation? And if so, one question came in regarding the types of calculations and different proof that you've used to meet LEED designation under the solar hot water package. Is there any insight you can provide on that question?
At 4600, they're not considering LEED at this time.
Earthcraft certification on its property in 2009, so we're not looking at LEED.
Okay.
I would think LEEDs would be most important if you're doing a brand new building. Illustrations, I think, from the others are existing buildings. One was built in, 1954, so it's a little harder to bring those up to LEEDs and may not be worth it.
Great. In terms of geographical area, we've had two projects that are based in the Mid-Atlantic. What type of issues or considerations does one need to make if you're considering a system farther north or farther south? And do systems have equal opportunities in any region of the country?
Well, Ben Gravely here. I probably can answer that. The sun shines everywhere on the earth. It shines more in some places and less in others. If it's good sunshine, then solar will work. If you're in Boston or Alaska or Tibet, the mountains of Tibet, we did a system, calculated a system for that, where 50 below zero is typical, but it's extremely bright and sunny. And we could get very good performance out of our calculations. One rule of thumb is, back in the 80s, people would say, well, Boston is very cloudy, so forget doing any kind of solar in Boston. It's just not worth it because you won't get a lot of solar radiation on your collectors. Normally, what that does is you tag that into the percent of solar performance that you expect to get. And a cheap and dirty way to look at it is to say, what is your sky clearness factor? Over the course of a year, what percent of full sunlight do you get? I think Boston, I don't remember exactly, but let's say it's 45%. Then you can expect to get 45% of your heating maximum out of that climate. If you go to Arizona, where they have 97% clear days, solar days, then you can expect to get 97%. So the answer is yes, solar will work anywhere, but you have to tune it with proper expectations, and not if you overdo it, you waste a lot of money. You pay for every solar collector you put up there, and the marginal amount of energy you get may not be worth going over a certain amount. So the answer is there's very few places where solar won't work as long as you adapt it properly.
Do you recommend any types of software or calculations that provide information on energy savings or payback? I could go to anyone, perhaps Nina. I'm not sure in your due diligence, did you use anything? Or Ben, is there something that the industry uses broadly?
Nina, go ahead if you've got something.
Not really. Again, because Skyline presented this as a zero cost to us, we were mostly just looking at what would be our – it seemed like a no-lose except for our due diligence investment. So we did not do a calculation on that.
From a technology standpoint, there are multiple programs that calculate the solar energy value, the technical part. And once you have that energy value and you can stick a cost – installed cost number to it, then you're off and running for your basis of numbers for doing payback and the value, the economic value of the system. There is a free software program called RETScreen, RETScreen, that was developed by the Canadian government and NASA, U.S. government. And it starts out, the front end is a technical program. You put in collectors and you put in the load of the building and you put in the size of storage, and it will tell you how much solar energy you'll get. And then you keep moving through the pages, and it will do all kinds of financial calculations for you. We have our own software we do in-house because the financial calculations are so dependent on tax credits, tax liability of the owner, what region the building's in. It's very hard for one program to do it all. So we have to do a whole – we have a whole section of our company that is nothing but our finance department. And we have an investment banker who does these calculations. So it's pretty hairy. But in terms of the technical calculation of how much hot water you're going to get, a program like RETScreen will do it. There are other programs. One's called the F-Chart. There's PolySun. So that there are three or four sets of programs. They're all meant for the engineer, not so much for the building owner.
Let's see, maybe take one or two more questions here. There was a question regarding life expectancy of evacuated tubes, given the investment and operational time horizons that the different speakers and projects that we've covered today. How long do you typically expect these panels to last?
Harry, I think, wasn't your project the one with evacuated tube collectors on it?
It's true, but we're just going on what Skyline told us. They said that there are currently systems 25 to 30 years old using this equipment. So that's what we projected, the life expectancy of the system that they installed.
Okay. My experience has been with flat plate collectors since 1977. And I have some systems that were installed in 1980 that are still running with flat plate collectors. So the collectors themselves can last a long time. Evacuated tubes are more fragile than flat plate. They can get hotter inside, and rain or something can break them, and you can replace the tubes on some brands, and some brands it's hard to replace the individual tubes. But a more important or an equally important consideration is not just the collector itself, but it's the quality of the installation. The collectors can last forever, but if the insulation on the pipes rots off the pipes, if it wasn't installed well, if it was put on wooden bases that can rot and wear, then the rest of the system can go to pieces and you can have a mess 10, 15 years down the road. one of the considerations we use is mounting the collectors, that we get them up off the roof. We do not mount collectors on the roof. A lot of people do that. That's called the ballasted system. But we spend a little bit more money and get them about 18 inches off the roof so that the owner of the building can re-roof under the collectors without touching them. You don't have to move them. You don't have to disconnect them. You don't have to take them off the roof. So we decided to go that route, and it costs a little more money to get that kind of frame, but it helps the lifetime of the system, and it helps the cost of re-roofing a great deal.
This last question, I think it might be in reference to something you mentioned, Harry. There was a regulation that requires commercial buildings to report energy spending. Do you have any more information on that for one of our attendees, listeners?
Sure. Let me refer you to the department's website. It's ddoe.dc.gov. That's District Department of Environment. If you go to their website, look for the energy heading tab. Click on that and look for benchmarking, and it'll fill you in on what the requirements are, what the filing deadlines will be, what needs to be benchmarked, things like that. And it includes electricity, gas, and water at this time.
Okay, I think that might do it for today. I think we've worked our way through all the questions from our listeners, and I want to thank each of the presenters today for sharing their expertise and information. And as I mentioned earlier, each of the registrants for today's webinar will receive a link to the presentation itself, a PDF version of it, as well as an audio replay. So keep an eye out for that in your email, and thank you for attending today's webinar.
Thank you, James.
This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.